Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCain. As we near the election, we're aware that every vote matters. Unfortunately, for many years, Republicans have been working to reverse voting rights, making it harder for those likely to vote Democratic to be able to cast their ballots. Most attention on voting rights suppression has been focused on the Black vote. Little notice has been given to the attack on voting rights of Native Americans. We all know the story of how Europeans arrived in the New World and took land from the Native people who lived here. Most of us know about the treaties signed by the U.S. government and then broken. Few of us realize the current day efforts to undermine the ability of Native people to vote. Our guest today has just written a book on that topic. Professor Jean Schrodel is the author of Voting in Indian Country. She is a professor of public policy at Claremont Graduate University, who has written or co-edited 6 books. Her just published book, Voting in Indian Country, grew out of her work researching, writing, and consulting about Native voting rights over the past decade. Professor Jean Schrodel, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Great. Well, I think your topic about Indian voting rights is both a matter of kind of a moral imperative of doing the right thing, and it's also a practical imperative of we really need every person who can vote to be able to vote in this election, the most important probably in the history of the country. So I appreciate you doing that work.
Thank you.
Can you start us off and say, for people who might dismiss the Native American vote as so small as to be insignificant, how important is the Native American vote? I would imagine the Native vote is a significant percentage of voters in some Western states, but are there places where the Native vote might actually affect the outcome?
Absolutely. I mean, it is obviously most important in Western states, particularly those with large populations. So we could be talking about Montana, which has a very close Senate race at this point. I might add that John Tester attributes his election in the past 3 elections to his getting the very, very strong vote from the Native area precincts. But so we're talking Montana. Interestingly, Nevada. Nevada, there's relatively small Native population, just under 2% of the population. But what does that mean in that small population state? That means there are 55,000 voting age Native people who have generally voted very strongly Democratic. I mean, big one, obviously, that is being contested right now, one of the most important battleground states, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Native population there, I think it's about a bit over 5%. I think it's about 5.3%. And I did some looking, interestingly. I looked at Kristen Sinema's race, and the area where she got the highest proportion of support was from precincts with Native American populations on reservations. We tend to forget this population. We talk about the Black vote. We talk about the Latino vote. We talk about the women's vote. And we talk about the Jewish vote. But the Native population here is every bit the same rough size as that of the Jewish vote. So it's crazy in a sense that they have been ignored and gotten very little attention. Also, interestingly, just throwing out, since we're thinking about battleground states, North Carolina. North Carolina has, again, just slightly under 2% of its population is Native. You may recall in 2018, when the House race that had to be rerun through fraudulent actions, I might add at that point, on the part of a Republican, even though it's always accused of the Democrats. Mm-hmm. One of the populations that had these problems with their ballots being filled in, disappeared, all sorts of problems, were the Lumbee. The media paid very, very little attention to that, but that is a Native population in North Carolina, one of the current battleground states. But I would say politicians, whatever race you're running in, if you're running at a state level, state legislature, you're running for governor, you're running for the House, Senate, you need to pay attention, though, to the issues that are important to this population. In North Carolina, the race I was just talking about, the Republican came out in support of federal recognition of the Lumbee. The Lumbee are a state-recognized tribe. Made a big difference in, when the race was rerun, that both the Democrat and the Republican had taken this position. It cut into what was going to be probably a fairly substantial lead for the Democrat. So both parties have to pay attention.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important. And, you know, hopefully we all learned in the presidential election in 2016 how important every vote is. I mean, the fact that Trump got into the White House with just 70,000 votes from three states, like, really, anybody who says to me, well, my vote doesn't matter, my vote doesn't make a difference, like, no, every vote matters, and your vote can very much make a difference. So the numbers here you're talking about, given how close these races can be, can actually tip an election. So we really, I so agree with you, we need to be paying more attention to the Native American vote. And yet, in spite of that, there seems to be quite a bit of obstacles put in the path for Native peoples to vote. And you started looking around. And what did you find about some of the obstacles for Native Americans voting?
Wow. I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon because all of the things that we have heard about affecting and making it harder for African Americans to vote apply at least as much and generally speaking more. And I don't say that lightly because the barriers interact with the history and in a large extent the general isolation, geographic isolation of many of these populations. Let me give you an example that literally just came out earlier today and got some notice. One of the Alaska villages did not get any of the ballots. No ballots showed up in one of the Alaska villages in the primary. That whole population was disenfranchised in the Alaska primary. Just came out, it was a village called Metarvik. I may be pronouncing it a little bit wrong because I am not a native speaker of that language. Alaska villages, the main air service that brought mail of all sorts to the villages was going into bankruptcy in April. So Alaska villages have very deep issues that no other place in the country does in terms of having access to the ballot. But there's a huge range. Would you like me to just give you a kind of quick tour?
Well, yeah, just like what would you say are the most, like two or three most common ways that it's made hard for Native Americans to vote?
Okay. Travel distance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know from academic research that is well established that looks at urban areas, if you move a polling place as little as a quarter of a mile, that it has a negative effect, statistically significant negative effect on turnout. But we are oftentimes looking at areas that sometimes people have to travel several hundred miles to vote. I mean, literally, I am kidding you not. Or right now, this intersects with the pandemic. One of the big pushes is to vote by mail, which in my book, when I sent it to the publisher, I was saying it was something that both liberals and conservatives were endorsing. Conservatives liked it because it was cheap, it saved money. Democrats thought it would be good because more people would vote without thinking about the impact on Native populations. So you have people, many of them are quite poor. They do not have the kind of mail service that you and I are used to having. Most Americans, we get our mail. I literally take a few steps outside of my door to get my mail. Mm-hmm. But most people on reservations do not have home mail delivery. They do not have traditional addresses, which is something that came up in the 2018 North Dakota election. But in addition to that, they have very few post offices. I mean, let me give you an example. There is in the Navajo Reservation, Navajo Reservation is bigger than the state of West Virginia. So we're talking a very large space, geographic space. West Virginia has 725 post offices. Okay. Navajo Nation, the reservation, has a grand total of 40 places where you can mail or receive mail. But not all of those are even post offices. Many of them are what are called postal provider offices, which are little places. There's a couple hours at a gas station or a mini mart or one of those places where you can get your mail. So one area, which is interesting in a sad way, there is three precincts. This is in Apache County, very rural. It's designated as a rural county. Three precincts.
Like what state would the Apache be in?
Oh, this is Arizona. My apologies. Navajo Reservation, most of it is in Arizona. There's a bit that goes into Utah and New Mexico. Mm-hmm. The Arizona portion is just under 70%. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, is bigger than 9 states, just the Arizona portion. But precincts of Denihatsu, Mexican Water, and Rock Point do not have one single post office. This is 871 square miles. We're in the middle of a pandemic. 555 Navajo have died. So they have two of those little postal provider offices in 871 square miles. I looked at some of the off-reservation places. Now, we know the urban areas have a lot of post offices. You know, I mean, if you go to Phoenix or you go to any of the larger cities, you'll have a lot of post offices. But it's interesting, I discovered, and again, I did kind of a deep dive, I found that in Apache County, the county that I was just mentioning, off reservation, there are four full service post offices, not postal provider offices, that have in the census designated places, CDPs, larger than a town or something, there are full post offices in places with population 122, 6, 41, 36, and 26. Full post office, yet off on the reservation, you have places that have several thousand people that do not have full post offices. So voting by mail, travel distance, big issue.
Yeah, that's huge. And having to travel 700 miles to vote would make even the most dedicated voter might have a hard time just paying for the gas alone, or having a vehicle to get to the polling station would be hard. And of course, we all know in the era of COVID how dangerous it can be to actually show up at a polling site. So now, do you think this travel distance issue and this lack of postal services, like so few post offices, is this a deliberate attempt at disenfranchisement, or is this kind of the post office just saying there's not enough activity to warrant having a postal service station there?
That's a great question. Thank you, Eleanor. It's something I've been thinking about, because right now we're in a moment where a large portion of people in this country were having to come to grips, the kind of racial reckoning, if you will, and grappling with things about structural, institutional racism, historical patterns. And the post office issue, I mean, I have to be honest, I was really surprised when I started looking at where post offices were. But most of these post offices were established a very long time ago, 100, 150 years ago. And it was a means to bind the country together. So they were established in these places where there were white populations, generally white populations. And so it has become, it's a carryover, if you will, from that historical period. And I think there's a lot of lack of recognition of the racially discriminatory implications. I know that people in some of those small rural white areas would fight tooth and nail if someone came and said, we're going to close your post office so that we can open one on the reservation. But the cost, I mean, people, you know, the post office is being stressed. The USPS is being stressed financially because what about, I think it was 14 years ago, it was told that they had to be a profit-making center as opposed to a service. So I think this is a kind of part of the structural, institutional, unthought about racism, where the racism, though, that comes in a more conscious sense, is when we as a people do not step up to address those inequities. And then it becomes something on us in a contemporary period.
Right. Well, and you know, so much of this is you get this built-in racial bias from, you know, 100, 150 years. This has been going on a long time. But I think, you know, most people just aren't aware of it. And you know, I think if they were aware, they might take some action for it. You know, I look at what's happened over the past couple of years in terms of the police brutality towards the Blacks. You know, that we whites are kind of becoming cognizant of this because we got George Floyd in an 8-minute video showing the police officer literally with his foot on his neck killing this man. And people, when they saw it, were rightly outraged. And there was massive support even among whites for racial justice and policing. But, you know, we've had so few, you know, actual seeing what is happening. It's an invisible issue. And I think in some ways, so people think, oh, well, that battle happened back in the Puritans 300 years ago. The Europeans arrived, they took the land, they killed the native people. And, you know, it's unfortunate that happened, but hey, that's life. And now we're here and it's 300 years later. So life goes on. And almost an assumption like there are no more Native Americans in the country. It's like, it's so invisible. And every now and then it pokes out, as you talk about in your book, and we see with the around the Dakota Pipeline and the attention that the Native Americans all united around to stop the pipeline being put under their water supply system. And so many people said, hey, that's wrong, and went out physically to support and confront and the company trying to put this project in, which, by the way, happy ending after years of protests that that pipeline has been stopped. So, but, you know, it's just one of these invisible problems that your book is now trying to rectify that by, and congratulations to you and thanks to you for bringing some attention to this like invisible issue.
I think if you do not live in one of the states where you are close to a reservation or a native population, it's easy to be ignorant. I was ignorant. I claim no credit for being some incredibly woke individual. I mean, I had a student who was native who came to me, a man named Darren Marquez from the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, and basically he slapped me upside the head and said, how come you're not looking at, you know, you teach classes in American politics and you talk about race, but you don't talk about, and I'm going, wow. I mean, you know, it was one of those
light bulb moment.
Light bulb moments. But then I traveled. And I traveled to Montana. I traveled to the Dakotas. I traveled to Nevada and some of these places, and what I saw appalled me. I mean, and this was, I might add, pre-Donald Trump, pre-Trump. And I think in a way we've become used to some of the more blatant racism, kind of in-your-face racism during the Trump era, but when I was in the Dakotas, the kind of racism, the casual racism of white people shocked me. I mean, I had never thought that I had to pay attention to where I went to eat to make sure I went to some place, to a cafe that was, quote, Indian friendly. Yeah, I mean, I had took with me to do some work. One of my team was a fairly dark-skinned Latino, and he got harassed in the in front of the post office in the county seat in Jackson County, South Dakota. But let me give you this little side. I have a brand new Jackson County story. So if any of your listeners are in Jackson County, Jackson County, the upper part of the county is white. The lower part is the eastern portion of the Pine Ridge Reservation. And it became combined after the Voting Rights Act, because the lower part had been a different county, Washoba County, and it looked like it was going to become a covered county under the Voting Rights Act. And so they merged it. I can't say for sure that was the motivation. I've tried to verify, but it sure looks like that. So it became part of this all-white county, which was divided. And incredible place. Very little connection between the two populations. And the was a voting rights case there in 2016. It was Poor Bear v. Jackson County, which forced the county to establish an early voting site in the at a place called Wombly, which turns out was the largest town in the county, but it was on reservation and all the early voting sites were off reservation in the white areas. And so they were forced through a settlement in this voting rights case to agree to establish an early voting site in Wombly through the 2022 election. Now, you may have noticed, you've seen the governor of South Dakota out there with Donald Trump, no mask, South Dakota doing nothing to protect themselves from COVID, right? But the interesting, funny thing is Jackson County, the county council just decided that because of the pandemic, they had to close the early voting site that was on the reservation. Now, they weren't closing the one where most of the white people vote. They were just closing the one on the reservation. Now, it's kind of hard to think that that was motivated by a deep, deep abiding concern for the Native population. I mean, it looks pretty, it looks pretty suspicious to me. But again, this will make it much harder for the people who are on the Pine Ridge Reservation in Jackson County to vote. Very few Native Americans in South Dakota actually vote by mail. Some places I've looked at, it is as little as zero. Again, very few post offices, but the other thing, South Dakota got a lot of kudos right after their primary, because their absentee voting went up 1,000%. So it was considered a great success, voting by mail. You saw no increases in the reservation precincts, and some of them did not have a single person voting by mail. And that's an interesting phenomenon, because South Dakota sent to every one of their registered voters a request for an absentee ballot. You just send it back, you supposedly could get an absentee ballot. But you were supposed to get that request notarized. Not a lot of notaries. Yeah, I mean, notaries are in banks, off reservation places.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, you talk about going to Jackson County, South Dakota with a team of students to check into this whole voting access question. How were you treated? Like, what was your experience? You're a white woman, you're going in. Were they like wondering if you were representing the government? Were they hostile? Were they curious? Did they appreciate your interest and support? Or what was your response? What response did you get personally from the Native Americans?
That's a great question. Thank you. I've now gone to quite a lot of places, and I have only gone to places where I've been asked to go and to do specific work. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe in the sort of, white savior, I'm coming to do something for all you poor benighted people. I'm a political scientist, I have certain skills. So Jackson County, I anticipated that I would feel uncomfortable on the reservation, that it would be culturally different. I found that the interactions in the white part of the county were much more surprising and troubling to me than on the reservation. We did surveys that were asking people, how much did travel distance affect your life, your ability to get groceries, your ability to get to work, your ability to do, and this whole long list. And we asked nothing about politics. We asked nothing aside from access to voting. Travel distance a problem there in the midst of all the other questions? We didn't ask about race. We didn't ask about politics. Yet large numbers of white respondents just automatically spoke about race and described, you know, racial animus, a lot of very nasty comments about President Obama. This was back in 2014. Oh my gosh, you don't even want to think what was said about Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. People proclaiming themselves to be proud racists. When we told people we were going to do the surveys on the reservation, the typical response was, don't go there, you'll get raped, you'll get attacked, you'll get killed. Of course, none of that happened. I mean, going on the reservation, Pine Ridge has been, it's right by one, it's where Wounded Knee is. Pine Ridge Reservation is where the site of the Wounded Knee massacre, the Wounded Knee standoff back in the 70s. So it is a place that is fraught. Tension on race is very high. I took a team, as I said, that was mostly white, but not entirely there. People were generally very gracious to
us. Native people.
Yes, they were very gracious. It was really interesting. And we did get stories. I mean, if you're doing this kind of academic research, you have to be very careful not to show biases, not bias racially, but just bias in responses. So we did a lot of listening and learned a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. The degree of poverty. We were doing surveys outside of a mini mart. Actually, it was the only place to get groceries on the reservations, a little mini mart. And I saw this one car kept coming back. And I spoke with the woman, and she was providing a kind of informal taxi service because people didn't have cars. And people talked about that the mini mart was expensive, but they did not want to go to the somewhat larger grocery store. It was maybe 50 miles away in the county seat, because people were racist and you would be harassed. They didn't have the money to go further away to Rapid City. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, the poverty, the sense of poverty. When we spoke about travel distance off reservation, I mean, the white people, it is a county that is hurting. I mean, we're talking rural, fairly depressed community. I think the white per cap, white family income was something like 23,000. Maybe it was per capita. And the native one was just under 6,000. So we're talking a poor county. Mm-hmm. White people talked about difficulty getting enough money to buy gas. Native people talked about that, but they also told me stories about people who froze to death in the winter. I didn't have those kind of stories being told to me by any of the off-reservation populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a terrible situation there. And you write eloquently in your book about history as being a living force to the present. Like it's this continuum. It's not just that, oh, we have a voting rights issue now in 2020, that this is a continuum that's going on since 1492, right to the present day. Can you give an example of some of how history shapes our current experience on the native lands?
Well, I mean, Louise Erdich was the one who first used the phrase living history. But when I speak with Native people, they will tell me they have a notion of history that is spiral. So what happens 7 generations ago, maybe like it happened yesterday. So there's a different sense of history as not being linear. but that sense, palpable sense, I was amazed at how many places in different states were named Custer. Yeah, in Montana, in Washington State, in South Dakota, time and time again, places honoring the memory of Custer. I saw places where little towns that would do historical reenactments of Custer's heroic stand. But you did not see any off-reservation places noting Wounded Knee, noting Sand Creek, Washita River, places that were massacres where the US military or state militias killed non-belligerent native groups. It's palpable, that sense of history. It's something I had to grapple with a lot myself when you're asking how people treated me, when not on Jackson County, but one point when I was in Montana, I was sent to speak with one older Native man who spent about 20 minutes telling me all the bad things that white people had ever done. And it's a long list. And he ended it by telling me that I did not have a soul. And then he assured me it wasn't really my fault, that I was actually a nice person, even if I didn't have a soul. But we're talking now about reparations. We're talking about the 1619 Project, and slavery is the original sin, but there is the sin that preceded that, that we are not talking about. One of the things, there is a bill in Congress right now. It's called the Remove the Stain Act. I don't know, probably very few of your listeners have heard of it. The Wounded Knee Massacre Remove the Stain Act is in the Senate. I believe it's Elizabeth Warren has been a main sponsor in the House. Deb Haaland, Sharice Davids. And what this act is, it says, we will remove the medals of honor from, I believe it was 20 members of the 7th Cavalry who murdered people at Wounded Knee. I mean, this was the biggest, largest number of medals of honor ever given for any military encounter. Mm-hmm. And it was a situation where the village Sioux were surrounded. They were not belligerent. There was some argument involving a elder man who was deaf, and that provoked it. And literally, 7th Cavalry had what are called Hotchkiss guns, which is an early version of a machine gun. And they literally massacred the people. And the Remove the Stain Act is saying, because the Medal of Honor is congressional, it's and Congress has in the past removed medals of honor from people when it turned out that their behavior was not honorable. This is something that would be an important statement, a step towards reckoning, a step towards reconciliation. None of the members of the Congress from the state of South Dakota are supporting the legislation. I mean, this would be a step.
You know, that sounds like a great bill, and I've never heard of it. And I follow what's happening on the Hill pretty closely. So that sounds like a good bill to support the Remove the Stain Act. What are other steps that we can take to try and improve the situation? I mean, you've done research now for about 10 years in this area. Who is doing good work? Where are there signs of hope? If our listeners wanted to engage and help right this wrong with the Native peoples, like who's doing the good work that needs to be supported?
Thank you, because there are so many folks who are wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people I am literally in awe of. So I know about the voting rights piece, so I can't speak to all of the other elements, but right now, NACAI, North American Congress of American Indians, is doing work on, you know, assisting people on registering to vote, assisting on if you run into problems. Native American Rights Fund, amazing, absolutely amazing group of attorneys, really stretched hard because they have to do all the different kinds of law. So the same people who were handling Dakota Access Pipeline from NARF, who were handling Bears Ears, were also handling voting rights cases up in Alaska. I mean, just, so it's a group that stretched, they're amazing lawyers, stretched very thin. I love the folks, and I'm sorry if I forget anybody, but the Arizona State University Indian Law Clinic, the Intertribal Council of Arizona, they have lawyers and law students who are on call during the early voting period and during election day, so when people run into problems. So I know that on the Gila River Reservation, so they were working to help ensure those people could actually vote. And the group that I work with a lot is Four Directions. Mm-hmm. I've worked more closely with Four Directions than any other group.
Go ahead and explain what Four Directions does.
Four Directions is a voter education, get out the vote, voting rights, grassroots organization out of Mission South Dakota, the Rosebud Sioux Reservation. They did work to assist the Lumbee in North Carolina. They have done a lot of work in Montana, Nevada, the Dakotas, Arizona. I know right now they're wrapping up working with Navajo on registering people to vote on the Navajo Nation Reservation. I spoke with someone yesterday. They've registered in the last 3 weeks about 2,500 people. They're also working right now with tribal groups in Minnesota on registration. Minnesota, you can register to vote up to the very last, up to election day. So helping people, but it's the grassroots folks. They're not the lawyers. I love it. They're ordinary. You know, it's easy for us to forget sometimes. We think about heroes as these bigger than life folks who you have a statue of, not one of the Confederates, but yeah, bigger than life, somehow saints, that's the sort of people we could never do what some of these folks do. But I think on the voting rights piece, there's some amazing heroes. John Lewis, mm-hmm. who was intertribal council in Arizona, and the people from Four Directions. I mean, I love that one of the co-directors is a man who had an eighth grade education. You don't have to be a PhD. You don't have to be a lawyer to be able to do something that truly matters in this world. So I feel so absolutely privileged that I've had the opportunity to get to know a number of these people. I mean, one of the things that I tried to do in this book was give voice, allow many of these people to tell their own stories. I love one of the individuals who I spoke to, who is, I did oral histories, and the last one that I included in the book was from a man named Johnny Williams Jr. And he is from the Walker River Reservation. He's Paiute, and he was a plaintiff in the Sanchez v. Sigvoski voting rights case. And I sat in his home, and he started telling me about his life. And much of what he spoke to me about was his experience in the Vietnam War. He was in the midst of lots of very, very hard fighting. And he's 80% disabled today. And he passed on, unfortunately, Agent Orange problems to his children. But he agreed to be, he chose to be a plaintiff in this case. And when he went to court, he was amazed that the judge in this case was someone named Miranda Du, the federal district judge. She was a Vietnamese American. And what he discovered was that Judge Du had been one of those babies that were, for those of us who are old enough or have seen the pictures with the soldiers who were helping put babies onto helicopters during the fall, the end of the fall of Saigon and places. And Johnny Williams Jr. said to me that he was one of the soldiers who was helping people onto the helicopters. And he said he was so amazed, that sense, if you will, of spiral of history, that Judge Du, who maybe he saved her life, or maybe didn't, but he could have, was the one who ruled in this voting rights case and ruled that, yes, these people had to have a place to vote on their reservations, the early voting sites, places where they did not have to travel. And she, one of her statements was, 32 miles is too far to have to go to vote. And I loved the sense. I thought Johnny Williams Jr., all the things that he had suffered and paid the price as an American, of all the people who should not have to struggle to be able to vote, he certainly was one. But the sense, I mean, it brought tears to my eyes. And so his story is in there. I have the stories of some of the lawyers. I have the stories of some of the grassroots people. And my hope is not just that someone who reads this book will learn about voting rights. Yes, I hope that, obviously. Mm-hmm. But when I say the view from the trenches as part of the title, I want people to understand and see how this fits in to the broader history, a sense of the lives of people. I mean, the stories are about voting rights, but they also are about all of the experiences of Native people, both in the past and in the present period. Anyhow, so that's kind of a chunk of what I was trying to do, or am trying to do.
Yes, I think you did it very well. And you know, I think this is a powerful story about the Vietnamese woman judge saying, yes, the Native peoples deserve the right to vote. And, you know, as we make breakthroughs and advances somewhere, then people can turn around and help bring others behind them. And I was struck also kind of on that theme, where after the organizing for the Dakota Access Pipeline, that inspired a number of Native Americans to run for Congress and and other offices. But we got the first two Native American women elected to the U.S. Congress in 2018. So I was so astounded and excited when that happened. Because we've talked about, yes, the Native vote can be affect a close race, but to have someone has to get majority voting to win. So obviously these Native Americans developed a coalition and a number of other people to support them to get elected. And what do you see happening? Was that like a one-time spurt after the Dakota Pipeline, or because of the success, and now they say, oh, if we actually mobilize and vote, we can get our people into these elected offices? Are they kind of building on that success, or was it like, you know, a one-time response to the pipeline?
Well, it was interesting because the voting in 2018 on the reservations, after the Supreme Court was allowing the state to put in the requirement that you had identification with a residential street address, fully knowing that they didn't have these addresses and people had to create this. Turnout was higher in 2018 on those reservation precincts than had ever been in any election, full stop, even though it was an off year. So it can be mobilized. People can mobilize. Montana is a great example. Montana has now, I think there are 12 people running for office in Montana. The representation in the state legislature is just a little bit higher than their actual representation in the population. So it's happening. It takes a lot of resources. But it was exciting to see Charisse Davids and Deb Holland, who I might add are joining. When they came to Congress, they joined the two Native American men, Tom Cole and Mark Wayne Mullen, who, by the way, are Republicans. So it's a interesting fact. But Dakota Access Pipeline, Standing Rock, what I'm hearing is that had a tremendous effect, particularly on younger people, the younger Native populations. And it also, it brought together groups that traditionally had not been close, had not been allies. We talk about history. I mean, there were conflicts among Native nations towards one another, completely separate from Europeans and Euro-Americans. But there were support from over 300 different tribes at Standing Rock, including some that were not traditional friends of the Sioux. I'm also seeing more creation of organizations that cut across some of those different groups. There's a group called TASSN. TASSN, I can't remember the exact, anyhow, Southern California, but there's also CULT, Coalition of Large Land Tribes, which brought together a lot of these very disparate groups from the plains and mountain states. So I think we're going to see continuing action. I don't know if you saw, because it was a state race, the person who in the North Dakota state legislature, who had been the primary backer of those truly horrible voting voter identification laws, was defeated in
2018. I love to see that.
And the person who defeated him was Ruth Buffalo, a Native woman. I mean, that is really telling. And that was in a traditionally Republican district. So.
Well, that's exciting. Good for her.
Yeah, she's pretty cool. I've actually met her a few times.
Yeah. Well, we just have about 30 seconds left. So if you could briefly say, you know, we know Trump has been a disaster for the environment and for voting rights for everyone, including Natives, Blacks, whoever he can stop who might vote Democratic. What are we likely to see from Joe Biden if he's elected president? I don't recall him saying anything about Native Americans, but what do you see him doing if he gets elected?
Well, my sincere hope, this is my partisan side coming out, not only does Joe Biden get elected, but we have a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, and we pass things such as the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and we pass the Native American Voting Rights Act, both of which are designed to redress a lot of these abuses. The first one would deal primarily with things, the Section 4B, Section 5 Voting Rights Act that was overturned by the Supreme Court in Shelby. The second one really addresses the specific, some of the things that I've been talking to you about, the specific significant additional barriers that affect Native populations. So let's not just hope for Joe Biden, but let's hope for a House and a Senate. And God help us, the Supreme Court.
Right. Good. Well, sorry. On that hopeful note, I want to thank you so much. That's all the time we have. Professor Jean Schrodel is the author of Voting in Indian Country. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're in the archives. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.